by like one of these postcard notices sent out the following to me and counsel for Texas State Teachers Association. Dear sir, you are hereby notified that the relator's motion for leave to file original petition for temporary injunction was this day submitted and overruled. Enclosed is your check number 384 in the amount of $30. Now,
Dear John.
The question now becomes,
what were you asking to be in? What injunction were you seeking?
The Texas State Teachers Association was seeking.
What were they seeking?
In their an injunction to keep the test from being graded or the results to be revealed to the school district.
That's the same injunction that has been issued here that we stayed.
It's more limited than that. Judge Garcia went beyond that and asked that the actual physical test of the petitioners in that case be located and returned to the district court. The Texas State Teachers Association did not ask for that remedy. They simply asked that the test not be graded or that the results, in the event that the test were graded, the results would not be revealed. As a practical matter, at this time, for the court's information, those tests have been graded. The information is being assembled at this time, and the actual individual letters are being written up, and those should be mailed to the individual teachers, absent any unforeseen problems, probably a week from this weekend, which will be approximately the 5th of May. The only court, with respect to whether or not that is the decision on the merits, the only case that we could find.
All right, this morning, and I appreciate it, Mr. Hunt. And I believe I'll go ahead and place it up where the court can see it. As you can see, basically, the instrument is styled on the top a mineral deed, and the granting clause has the standard provisions that are used and have been used throughout the state of Texas for many years. That is, it conveyed an undivided 1/16th interest into all of the oil, gas, and other minerals in and under, and that may be produced from the following described lands, and then describes the land and premises. Then it adds the words, but does not participate in any rentals or leases, stuck in the blank space of a standard mineral deed form where normally the description goes. The deed goes ahead and continues, containing 340 acres more or less, together with a right of ingress and egress at all times for the purpose of mining, drilling, exploring, operating, and developing said lands for oil, gas, and other minerals, and storing, handling, transporting, and marketing the same therefrom, with the right to remove from said land and premises all of grantees' property and improvements. The issue before the court this morning, as was before the Court of Civil Appeals, is whether or not this instrument conveys a 1/16th royalty or a 1/16th of the normal 1/8th royalty. And in this case, this land and premises was leased for a 1/8th royalty, and there is now production on the same. The Court of Civil Appeals, as well as the trial court in summary judgment, found that this instrument, because it did not give the grantee the right to lease or the right to receive the rentals and bonuses, stripped it of all of the instances of ownership of minerals, and therefore made it a blanket royalty interest of 1/16th. The petitioner vehemently disagrees with the decision of the Court of Civil Appeals and feels like that it is in direct conflict with numerous cases that have set out this type of provisions in the state of Texas for many years. Basically, if we follow the Court of Civil Appeals decision that was granted in this case, then the case of Delta Drilling Company versus Simmons, the case of Etter, the case of Gresham versus Gutterslaw, and the case of Richardson versus Hartz are all incorrect. All of those cases, Your Honors, provided the same direct wording in the granting clause, provided down somewhere in the rest of the instrument that the owner of that interest would not be entitled to participate in the leasing, would not be entitled to participate in the bonuses, and would not be entitled to participate in the rentals. The Court of Civil Appeals in its decision has basically stated, no leasing rights, not minerals, but royalty. Certainly, we feel like that you can own a mineral interest and an interest in the minerals under the ground without having the right to lease, or without having the right to receive bonuses or rentals. I think under this instrument that the grantee would have the right to go in there and drill and develop the minerals himself without it being leased. Even though it's only a 1/16th interest, of course, if he did, then he would have to carry the owners of the other minerals and receive his expenses from it if it was a producer, and if not, then would have to bear all of the cost of drilling that well. I think that if we take this instrument, and instead of having the 1/16th, we place different fractions thereon of 1/2 or 3/4, then it becomes quite clear that under this type of instrument that you would have to hold that it is an interest in minerals and not a royalty interest. Certainly we all recognize that if the instrument had 3/4 interest instead of a 1/16th interest, and under the Court of Civil Appeals hearing there was a 3/4 royalty, then the minerals would be killed and of no use or value. Again, we feel like that under this instrument that the grantee would have had the right to use his own minerals. And as in the cases of Delta and Etter and the other cases, those cases did not retain the leasing rights, and yet they were held to be minerals. The Court of Civil Appeals seemed to rely upon the case of Watkins versus Slaughter. And Mr. Hunt, in his brief, has put on one page the granting clause under the Watkins case and the granting clause under the Altman case, and the reservation of the leasing rights under the Watkins case and the reservation of the leasing rights under the Altman case. But he forgot in the Court of Civil Appeals, in its decision, forgets to point out that in the Watkins case, down in the bottom part of the instrument, it went ahead and provided that the interest herein retained shall, or the royalty herein retained, shall be from actual production. I do not feel like this instrument is ambiguous. This case, in the case of Alford, had an instrument that basically started out the same as this one, with the same granting clause. Certainly there was a conflict in that case, but down in the bottom part of it, the grantor and the grantee tried to go ahead and express their interest and provide that we each on future leases shall own 1/2 of the leasing rights and 1/2 of the royalties to be paid, which was in direct conflict with the granting clause. In my opinion, that case was a lot stronger case to make a different instrument out of it than this one. The only thing that we have to look at in this case is how much of the production that the grantee is to receive is the granting clause. And when we read it, it provides 1/8 of the gas, all gas numbers, in, on, and under. And certainly, that means from time and time again that it's got to be 1/16 of the normal 1/8. Thank you, Jim.
Let me ask you a question. If you can't lease, And if you can't collect delay rent rentals, how does the interest of the Blake senior heirs differ from a royalty interest?
I think basically it's the same, to a certain extent, it's the same thing. But I think you have to look at this to determine what portion of the royalty they are going to get. First place, I still think that under this instrument, even though they do not have the right to lease and the right to receive the bonuses, when it provides that they have the right of ingress and egress for the purpose of mining and drilling and exploring, and that they have the right to remove that property that they use in mining, drilling, and exploring, that they have the right to elect to go in there and drill it themselves and produce those minerals themselves. And a royalty interest does not have that.
Thank you, Ken. Hear from the respondent.
Mr. Donald M. Hunt will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. My appearance, of course, is on behalf of the appellee respondent, W.R. Blake III and Jacqueline Blake Beatty, who will collectively be called Blake. The court has heard the position of petitioner Altman. Blake responds with a single argument. The Court of Appeals was correct because a severed mineral estate stripped of all the central attributes except royalty conveys only royalty. This is a constructional argument based on the words of the 1938 deed. The words can be construed by applying the applicable rules of construction. A single case gives a number of the helpful rules. It's this court's 1954 decision of Woods against Sims. As here pertinent, this court said in Woods, there being no allegation of fraud, accident, or mistake, the court will give effect to the intention of the parties as expressed by the instrument. This rule has direct application to this case. Neither party claims that there's been any accident or fraud or mistake. Neither party asserts that the deed is even ambiguous. Both move for summary judgment on the basis that the words of the deed are clear and that the intent the court must find must come from the words of the instrument. That's the rule that should be applied. But this court in Woods didn't stop with that initial rule of construction. It continued as follows. Generally, the parties intend every clause to have effect, and this purpose should not be thwarted except in the plainest case of necessary repugnance. This rule may have double application because the challenge before the court is to give meaning to every phrase and clause, yet at the same time resolving any repugnancy. And there may indeed be a repugnancy here. But finally, this court in Woods observed what should happen where there is conflict. Where different parts appear to be contradictory, the court will, if possible, harmonize the parts. Now, this harmonization can be provided by another rule of construction. It's the rule which arises when the parties insert information in a printed form. That rule comes from this court's 1957 decision of McMahon against Chrisman. This rule provides that inserted material, when in conflict with printed material, controls over the printed material. These rules of construction can now be applied and considered juxtaposed with the deed by looking at the attributes of a severed mineral estate. The authorities, in particular the scholars, teach that a severed mineral estate has five essential attributes. That is, if A conveys Blackacre to B, but retains all of the minerals, Then A has a severed mineral estate in which there are five attributes. The first is the right to enter on the property and develop it. This is often referred to as the right of ingress and egress. Closely connected with this right of ingress and egress is the power to lease, often called the executive right. Now the reason why the executive right and the right of ingress and egress are closely connected is that necessarily one must go with the other. The party with the power to lease must also have the power to grant ingress and egress to the lessee, or else the lease is wholly void. The party with the power of the lease must be able to grant to that lessee, the oil company, the right to enter and drill upon the property, or else the lease would be useless. So by implication, necessary common sense implication, that when a party has the executive rights, as Altman's claim they do, that with that executive rights go the right of ingress and egress. And the final three attributes of a severed mineral estate may be more quickly covered. The third attribute is the right to receive delay rentals. The fourth is the right to receive bonuses. And the fifth is the right to receive royalties. Blake argues that this warranty deed, properly construed, strips four of these attributes, reserves them to the grantor, and necessarily all that can be conveyed is royalty. The inserted sentence reserves the right to lease, and therefore the right of ingress and egress, reserves bonuses, reserves delay rentals, and all that leaves is royalty. Applying these rules of construction to the words of the deeds demonstrates that all is reserved except royalty. Consider now the words of the deed. First, without the inserted sentence. And the inserted sentence is that which has been highlighted in yellow. Now, without that inserted sentence, two things are clear. First, that this is the granting clause. It is the granting clause which, without the inserted sentence, has historically conveyed an undivided mineral estate in fee. There's no dispute about that. Next, that this language, without the inserted sentence, is standard language, as counsel for Altman recognizes, standard mineral deed language of deeds that were in common usage in 1938 and today. Now consider the words of the deed with this highlighted sentence inserted. Observe that this language above the highlight, together with this language below the highlight, is the granting clause, and it's a single sentence. Now inserted in the middle of the granting clause is another sentence. The party is then inserted in the printed form, but does not participate in any rentals or leases. That can be determined from
that's the... That's a sentence that's an inartfully drawn sentence, isn't it, Mr. Hunt?
Not any question about that, Justice Kilgarland. And you point up so beautifully the reason why the courts prefer the inserted words of the parties, because the printed words are those of the printer, those of the draftsman of the printed form. But the inartful words of the parties come more nearly expressing the intent of the parties. And that's the reason why this court in McMahon recognized that it's necessary to resolve conflict.
You're talking about intent of the parties. It's obvious that this was an intended limitation on the rights conveyed. And yet, from that intended limitation, you try to promote out of it a greater interest, a royalty interest, as opposed to a mineral interest.
This is correct.
Now, how can you go from an intended limitation to create a greater right?
Simply by trying to determine the intent of the parties from the language. After all, the characterization that this is a limitation is the conclusion. It is applying the conclusion to the language, and once the conclusion is applied to the language, then it's a self-fulfilling conclusion. That's not the way it should work. The way it should work is to look at the words of the document and determine what this inserted clause means before it can be determined whether it's a limitation on the grant or whether it is indeed stripping all attributes except royalty. And that's the problem the Court of Appeals face. That's the problem that this court faces. What does the inserted sentence mean? So consider this language now with this sentence inserted. It's inserted in the middle of the granting clause. This can be determined because this is a capital letter here, it's a period here, and it's a small letter here. Thus what happened is that the parties from the farm had to insert 1/16th interest, insert a description, insert 348 acres. That would have filled out the printed form and conveyed an undivided mineral interest in fee. But then the parties began either to limit or to strip essential attributes by inserting this phrase. So the task is, what does the phrase mean? Consider now the meaning of these words, but does not participate in any rental or leases. Look at it from the standpoint initially of does not participate in any leases. There are two ways a party may participate in the process of leasing. Of course, a party may execute a lease, and secondly, when the party executes the lease, that party may receive bonuses. But necessarily, what goes with executing of a lease is granting to that lessee the power to enter onto the property, develop, and drill. That's ingress and egress. And that creates the problem in this case. Notice here that while by implication, this inserted language where it says, but does not participate in leasing, includes execution, includes ingress and egress. But the deed apparently in this language, together with the right of ingress and egress, gives ingress and egress to the grantee rather than reserving it to the grantor. Thus the conflict and the need to return to the rule of McMahon against Chrisman and give controlling effect to the words that the parties inserted rather than the printed form.
Mr. Hunt, do I understand your argument to be that there cannot be two mineral interests, one with the executive rights and the other one without them?
No, Justice Wallace, that is not precisely what Blake argues. Of course, there can be a mineral estate where one party owning that mineral estate has executive rights and the other does not. But what this court recognized in Superior Oil Company against Stanline Oil and Gas in 1951 was that once executive rights are given to one party, even though it doesn't say exclusive, that of necessity that party must have exclusive leasing rights. So that the granting of leasing interest, as this court said in Delta, that the leasing interest granted to a party gives it exclusive leasing rights, and that party alone has the right to lease. That a single party has to have, by implication of necessary common sense construction, the right to execute leases, or else there will be leases executed by this fractional interest or that fractional interest.
Well, so maybe I misconstrued your argument as to the right of leases that's included in the highlighted yellow sentence inserted into the granting clause. And I thought I understood you to argue that because the right of leases was reserved, therefore there could not be another mineral interest. There could not be a mineral interest without a right to lease. Is that your argument?
No, Justice Wallace.
Well,
that can be separated. But let me retrace my steps. It's based on the belief that any sever mineral interest has five essential attributes. Now those attributes can be split up in different ways, but the argument is that the party that has the executive rights must necessarily have the right of ingress and egress. And that's the problem here. There appears to be a right of ingress and egress given to the grantee. But it's unquestioned by Petitioner Altman that Altman asserts the executive rights. And if Altman has the executive rights, and in fact has executed that lease, Altman had to give to the lessee a right of ingress and egress. Hence the conflict, hence the need to construe a use of MacMahon. So this really presents the problem of an internal conflict within the granting clause. And that's the reason why offered against Crum doesn't apply. There was a conflict in the granting clause and the after-acquired lease clause. And this court simply said, in its most recent decision on the matter, that the granting clause, when it conflicts with a clause somewhere else, controls. But that's not the problem here. Here the conflict is within the granting clause. And that's the reason.
I'm sorry I'm interrupting your argument, but I still have a problem here. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but two mineral interest owners, let's say each one of them owns 50% of the minerals. Each one of them has tenants in common, has a right of ingress and egress. Each one of them can go in and drill without getting the permission of the other.
This is correct. Provided.
So why could not the 1/16th mineral interest have a right of ingress and egress, and the reserved right of leasing on the part of the other party here have a right of ingress and egress? In other words, why is that right of ingress and egress in conflict with your highlighted section?
The answer is this, Justice Wallace, that if two parties own undivided half interest, and the document by which that undivided half interest is created makes no other separation of the five attributes, then both have all five attributes. Both can lease, both can receive delay rentals and bonuses. But the point is that once the document creating the severed mineral interest begins to withhold essential attributes of a mineral fee estate, then once four of the five are withheld and only royalty is left, then all that can be conveyed is royalty.
Well, how does that get away from my first question then? Two mineral interest, co-tenant mineral interest owners, one has executive rights and the other one doesn't.
The only way that one could have executive rights and the other one wouldn't is because the instrument that creates the separation of the estate gives rights of executive rights to one party or the other. Now this returns to this court's decision in Superior Oral against Stanline. In that case, this court said that where the document gave executive rights to one party without saying that it was exclusive, that of necessity, that party that got executive rights had exclusive executive rights. So it's a constructional problem of what to do with the instrument when it doesn't fully speak to the problem. But the questions you pose, Justice Wallace, are really constructional ones in the sense of when the estate is split, if nothing is said, both have all rights. But if when the estate is split, something is said that gives four of the attributes this way and leaves only royalty over here, then royalty is what must be conveyed.
Under what circumstances would a royalty owner have the right to drill?
None, Justice Kilgarland. If all that is owned is a royalty interest, the royalty owner has no right to drill.
And how can you contend, since that lease admittedly by you conveys to the grantee the right to drill, how can you say that that's conveying a royalty interest?
That's the conflict. The conflict between these words together with the right of ingress and egress and the implied reservation of right of ingress and egress, the right to develop, to the grantor by the language participate in leasing. A party participates in leasing by executing leases. The thing that a lease does is to give to the lessee the right to enter on the property to drill. So you've recognized the key problem there. By implication, the executive rights give that party the right to give to the lessee the right to enter and drill. or else the executive rights are wholly hollow, leases are meaningless. So if the grantor, if in this instance the grantor, petitioner, all reserved, as they now claim, the right to execute releases, then they of necessity claim the right to execute an effective lease, which means giving that lessee the right to enter and drill. And if that lessee gets the right to enter and drill, then that's in conflict with the grantee retaining the right to drill. And it's that conflict which presents the constructional problem. It's that conflict which the Justice Reynolds of the Court of Appeals resolved by giving controlling effect to the inserted subject.
Justice Reynolds resolved it by refusing to discuss any of the cases that are cited by Mr. Altman, for one thing, and you have not discussed them. Do you intend to deal with Delta Drilling? Do you intend to deal with the Etter case? Do you intend to deal with the Grissom case and tell us that they're not in point and why they're not in point and
yes,
how they're distinguishable? Do you intend, I don't mean to interrupt you and ask you to do it if you don't intend to do it. Have you intended to do it?
Yes, Chief Justice.
Is it on your notes?
I intend to do it in answer to questions or if there's any concern. Certainly, I've already spoken to Delta once. Let me clarify.
How did you speak to Delta? You mentioned the word Delta. How did you speak to Delta?
Simply in passing. Let me answer your question now.
I really would appreciate you doing that, because we have to write these opinions, as you know, based on what we believe the law, the case law is in the state.
Yep.
And we need to deal with these cases. Now, I'm not saying by these questions that I know that Delta Drilling is against you and that Etter is against you and Griffin is against you. I'm saying that's what he says.
Yes.
And what do you say in response to that?
In response, taking the cases one at a time. Delta Drilling against, I forgot the other name. Delta Drilling.
Simmons.
Delta Drilling can be distinguished on three grounds. The first is that the argument made here was never made in Delta Drilling. A review of the Court of Appeals opinion, a review of this Court's opinion, indicate that the argument was not made where the Court was asked to deal with a severed mental interest where part of the attributes were split apart from the others. That argument has never been made in that court or this court. Secondly, Delta can be distinguished because in Delta, the document didn't speak to bonuses. Nowhere in Delta did the document speak to bonuses. So bonuses was left with the estate. Contrary to what counsel says, that document can be read all day long, and that's an element that was not separated. So royalty and bonuses went together, and that was one attribute that was left connected with royalty, which left it a mineral fee estate. The third distinction is that this court used the primary rule of construction, discover the intent of the parties. And the intent of the parties could be discovered from a final paragraph which spelled out what interest was intended. The final paragraph that's missing here made clear that the intent of the parties was to convey an undivided one-fourth mineral fee estate.
Did you argue that distinction before the Court of Appeals?
Not in those words.
But did you argue the case before the Court of Appeals?
In oral argument, those cases were distinguished. In the briefing before the Court of Appeals, it does suggest that these cases are not applicable. In truth, though, the full-blown explanation of why they were not applicable was not given to the Court of Appeals. But it's not a matter of preservation of error.
No, I'm just curious as to why the cases don't appear anywhere in the Court of Appeals opinion.
I can't speak to why Justice Reynolds left those out. I can only suggest what is there, and by implication, he deals with the problem as I have argued it here, in the sense that there was something inserted and meaning had to be given to it. It simply is not as fully developed as I've attempted to develop it today. Now, the same distinction can be made as to Etter. Etter didn't involve a situation where there was bonus. Bonus, again, was not involved in Eder. That wasn't split apart. In addition, in Eder, that argument that's made here today was not made. Now, in Grissom, the case that most nearly approaches this one, there was a concession by the party in the position of Altman, a concession made at the Court of Appeals level that the executive rights went with the other party. But yet the document didn't speak to executive rights. It left it open. And that's the distinction with Grissom. The party conceded an essential attribute.
Have you noted the amicus brief?
Yes, I have.
Do you have any comments you want to make about the amicus brief, which asserts that those three cases are controlling and that for certainty of title we should follow them?
The easy answer to the amicus argument is that certainty of title is as easily achieved by a correct construction of a document that has this flaw in it. It's an easy argument to say, hold my way for certainty of title. That argument can be made by either parties to this lawsuit. Hold my way because titles will be impaired. But if this court adopts this construction of argument made here today, titles will be no less certain. It's simply a matter that this language has never been faced by any court. That this argument, carefully distilling the difference between the essential attributes, have never been urged quite in this way.
Do you take, I couldn't tell on the amicus why they claimed amicus status. Do you know?
No, Mr. Chief Justice, I do not.
Do you know whether they actually have some interest, that the lawyers that filed that amicus brief in this question pending?
I have a reason to guess, if the court would like to hear it.
No, I wouldn't want you to guess about it if you...
No, it is based only on supposition as to why the amicus might have an interest, but that is not expressed in the brief. I do not know of my own knowledge.
Okay.
Therefore, there only one conclusion can be reached. Effect must be given to the inserted sentence, and once effect is given, then all essential attributes of the severed mineral estate are reserved to the grantor, leaving only royalty to be conveyed. The judgment of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Could I hear from the petitioner?
Now, just one or two things. First of all, Mr. Hunt has addressed the Delta case and the Eder case, provided that it does not provide bonuses. And sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. And until last night, I didn't even realize that this provision didn't speak to bonuses, but only for rentals and leases. I don't know who's to get the bonuses under this. I know that it says nothing about it, and under Mr. Hunt's argument, then I think that the Blake interest would be entitled to the bonuses under that instrument. I think it comes down to, and I disagree with Mr. Hunt, that if you've got the leasing rights, you're the only one that can grant ingress and egress. I disagree with that, and I don't know of any cases that provide that that is the law. Certainly, if I own a one-half interest in the minerals and give you the right to lease, which we draw day in and day out, we reserve half of the minerals, but provide that the grantee shall have the right to lease, but that if he leases, I get my part of the bonuses, I get my part of the rentals. That's done every day. But under that provision, I, as the grantor, reserve the right of ingress and egress, and I think that I have got the right to go in, as you say, and develop those minerals on my own. If not, then what was these words provided for? And certainly we feel like that, number one, that all five of the attributes of minerals have not been stripped. He still has the right of egress and egress to develop the mine and develop those minerals, and if he does, to remove his property. Secondly, I don't know if he owes bonuses. He might still own the bonuses. Well, thank you, Joe.
We'll take a short recess. Determined that they in fact were exempt, and these exams are graded, and the
exam results are given to the school district, and then the school district, based on that, will not renew the contract, and at a later date it is determined that they in fact were exempt, we're going to have school teachers in our school system whose jobs have been taken away and they will not be able to go back in.
Now, the side of that same coin is we'll have school teachers in the school district that are not competent to teach.
Yes, and my response to that is, Your Honor, that we have principals, we have supervisors in the schools that should ensure that they don't have illiterate teachers, and that should be their responsibility. And that's why we have evaluation. I don't think there's anybody more qualified to evaluate a teacher's performance than the principal or its supervisor.
Well, we do have bar exams, though, to determine if lawyers are competent to practice and not leave it up to the judgment of an individual judge as to whether or not that fellow or lady is qualified to practice law, don't we?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Isn't that a similar situation?
It is, sir. And I'm not against having literate teachers. That's not my position at all. My position is that there are certain statutes on the books that specifically exempt a group. And if they feel otherwise, and Judge Calvert, in a decision some years ago, said that where the statutes appear as they do here, that the remedy is with the legislature to cure whatever exemption was there. And the job of this court...
Do you have any suggestions as to how we might facilitate and expedite the determination of this controversy? I'm hearing all sorts of procedural ploys here, really by both sides.
Yes, Your Honor. The Austin Court of Appeals case has gone up on a number of issues. The petition for leave to grant a temporary injunction did not include the 1332G argument, but it is one of the points of error that's on appeal. So it would seem to me that as soon as the Austin Court of Appeals addresses that or it can be expedited, that entire case could be expedited to this court, the whole issue could be resolved. But in response to Mr. O'Hanlon's previous comments, the Austin Court of Appeals was not asked to consider whether 13032G, whether that exemption should be a basis for the temporary injunction. And we both checked the papers this morning, and that was not an issue before it.
Counselor, that exemption you're talking about, is that part of HB 72?
No, Your Honor. It's a different statute altogether. And my position is that the legislature was aware of all of the statutes that existed under the books. That particular statute says two things. One, that you shall continue with your certification. And secondly, and more importantly, that you shall be governed by the rules and laws in effect at the effective date of that. And if a teacher was certified prior to that date, the law provides three conditions under which a certificate may be taken away, and it's limited to those, none of which include the taking of a TCAT exam.
And you don't think that point will be thoroughly briefed by the parties in the TSTA versus State of Texas?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm sure it will be.
That point may not be... may not have been preserved to get here so we can move on.